This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, as part of our special feature, Lawyers You'll Like, we'll talk with former Attorney General Ramsey Clark.
Ramsey Clark is one of the great radical lawyers of our time. From a Texas childhood to the Attorney General's office to a vociferous critic of what has happened to the rule of law today under the Bush administration, you will hear from one of the finer minds of our time.
We'll also hear the second of three parts from an event, An Innocent Man in Guantanamo, 5 Years of My Life. This is the title of the memoirs recently released by Murat Kurnaz, who was detained at Guantanamo for 5 years. Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Today we're going to bring you another important chapter of Lawyers You'll Like. And we're honored to have with us today Ramsey Clark, former Attorney General of the United States under President Johnson, the first Attorney General at the Justice Department to call for elimination of the death penalty and elimination of all electronic surveillance. He's an important figure, public figure, a figure in the progressive movement, a figure on the left. After he left the Johnson administration, he became a vociferous critic of the Vietnam War, and he continued on a radical path, defending the underdog, defending the rights of people all over the world, from Palestinians to Iraqis to others who found themselves at the repressive end of government action. He speaks really beautifully for all of us in talking about what are the issues we're facing going forward.
It's really a delight for all of us to have you here at the studio. You're one of our top heroes. You're from that generation that preceded ours. What we really is like the missing generation. We're from the 60s generation, Heidi's a little later, of people that got political. But you're a little older than us. For you to come where you started and where you are now as really a central leader of the movement in America is quite a story. And we're so happy to have you on Law and Disorder.
Well, it's great to be here.
I won't go through all my relations with Ramsey. Just to say, whenever I need serious advice on almost any political issue, I would go to Ramsey. So,
but Ramsey, let me one option.
Let me ask you this: your father was active in the Democratic Party in Texas. He was part of the whole Roosevelt coming to Washington. He was eventually asked to serve on the United States Supreme Court. Tom Clark, you followed in his footsteps, and you eventually became the Attorney General of the United States in the 60s. I remember the thing that most impressed me about you was later on, when you had educated yourself about the war in Vietnam and turned against it, became part of the whole social justice movement. And I remember being out in Michigan, staying at Jim Lafferty's house on his couch. And Jim said, you know who's the last person to sleep on this couch? And I said, no, who? And he said, Ramsey Clark. And I thought, well, you know, here's a dedicated person. Tell us, would you, how you grew to understand the nature of the American system and why you grew to oppose the war in Vietnam?
Well, you know, it's hard to know yourself that well, but a key factor in my life has been the death penalty. I remember in either late grammar school or junior high one time, a discussion of the death penalty came up. And I was a quiet kid, but I just couldn't stand it. You know, the idea that you'd have somebody in your hands and you could determine their fate any way you wanted to, and you'd kill them. And that I don't mean to say that I was dwelling on that constantly, but I was living in the times of Bonnie and Clyde, literally. I can remember the headlines in the Dallas Times Herald when Bonnie and Clyde were killed over in Oak Cliff, which is across the Trinity River from Dallas. But I didn't see the righteousness of the death penalty under any circumstances and that kind of... You know, I grew up in a legal family. My father was not in politics, really. He was a lawyer. He hitched his wagon to a fellow named Bill McCraw, who about the best speaker I ever heard, spontaneous speaker, had the biggest Sunday school class in Texas, and had the kids standing on the tables. And he ran for district attorney of Dallas County. Dad became the civil head of his civil division there. Then he ran for attorney general of Texas, McCraw did. Dad stayed in Dallas. Then he ran for governor and got defeated. And by that time, Dad decided he wanted to get into the federal government. And this would be 1937. I was about 8 years old. He got a job in the Department of Justice in the War Risk Litigation Section, which was litigating veterans' claims, really, from World War I. I remember one of his cases, I went out to Detroit with him, and this guy had a big claim for disability 20 years later. Turned out that he got the win somehow, but the guy was a champion bowler on the green up in Windsor, Ontario. So he was very happy to win that case that way, but he was against the suffering people, I guess you usually are in the Department of Justice. I joined the Marines when I was 17, and got out when I was 18, and saw a lot of misery and poverty. I saw destruction of World War II. They didn't send you overseas till you were 18 and during the war, if they knew it. And I couldn't get away with my date. I tried to when I was 13 on December the 8th, 41, but I was tall enough, I was too skinny to get to fool them. So the Marines had a big impact on me. I saw misery, and I saw violence, and I saw coerced discipline. I loved the guys I was with, but I didn't like the system, which is a system of absolute obedience to authority. And I came back. In the meantime, a guy named Robert Hutchins had caught my eye. I saw a picture of him in a football suit in a Time magazine, and he had abolished football at the University of Chicago.
Right, that's right.
And the year after, Jay Berwanger was the only All-American football player that ever came out of the University of Chicago, I think. Like, what a man. Because what makes more nonsense in higher education? That's why I'd started at the University of Texas on the GI Bill. I spent 2.5 years there, got married in the meantime, and George and I went up to Chicago. And Chicago was quite a different place than we think of it now. I mean, they were still investigating them for communists, which had been a big thing in the 30s. And the old faculty was still there, and Hutchins was an inspiring guy. I worked with him until he died after that. He created the Center for Study of Democratic Institutions out in Santa Barbara, which people just went out there and thought about things and wrote about them and tried to influence people, persuade them. So after I finished law school, I went back to, while I was in law school, Dad was appointed to the Supreme Court. I remember I'd been in a class with Ed Levy, I was very interested in antitrust law because I came out of Texas, and the populace still thought that you could harness capitalism, you know. Just keep it small. Break it up. Don't let them get a head start. We wouldn't let national banks into Texas until after I left. Now there are no Texas banks. They're all national or international banks. Anyway, I went back to Texas to practice law, and spent about 9 years at it and was doing pretty good. I became a named member in the firm, and I was doing some criminal law, and the two things I liked were criminal law and personal injury law, but we had corporate law and the rest of the stuff. But I came to realize that all I was doing was fighting over other people's money for them. I wanted something better to do. The Kennedy campaign caught my eye. It seemed exciting. I was in a protracted automobile parts Federal Trade Commission litigation at the time, going all over the country in these little factories. And so I didn't do any campaigning. I didn't know anybody in the any Kennedys or anybody in the campaign. But as soon as the election was over, I had two people I really knew and loved and respected. My father was on the court and kind of out of the picture, but I'd come to know William O. Douglas, who was a hero. He was a very close friend of Robert Hutchins. They were best buddies, literally. he and I had struck it off well. We loved the same sort of thing. And Sam Rayburn, who was from Bonham, Texas, and whose office was above a drugstore of my best buddy when I was at the University of Texas. So I'd come to know Sam Rayburn pretty well. And he always stood for integrity to me. When he died, he was called the second most powerful man in the United States during his years as Speaker of the House. When he died, he had about $25 in the bank and no money. I remember I'd bought a bunch of books like Mirabeau Lamar's, who was second governor of Texas, and second, I think, president of the Republic of Texas. He wrote poetry. I gave all my books about Texas to that little library, which is the only thing that Sam Rayburn was interested in when he died. And they both talked to President Kennedy and Robert Kennedy for me. I came up and interviewed Byron White first, who was named before Bob was. He was named Deputy Attorney General. I met with Bob, and then late November they said, we'd like for you to join. So I went up in January of 61, the beginning of the administration, and was assigned to Lands Division, which was natural resources, public lands, environment as it was then. We filed the first water pollution cases in the history of the United States, stuff like that. But because I was Southern and had a Southern accent, as soon as the Civil Rights Movement started overwhelming us, because we weren't in the advance, we were trying to hold the fort. And I was young. I was the youngest one in the crowd. But there were two of us from the South, Lou Oberdorfer, who was head of the tax division and a great guy and clerk for Justice Black. He was from Alabama. But Lou had problems in the South, and he was too busy in the tax division. So Bob put me into civil rights. I went down with Meredith and spent the first week he was on the campus with him and could literally pass. The others, you know, they thought this guy's a senior or a young graduate student or something. I could sit in the cafeteria, and I couldn't believe these pretty little young Mississippi gals cussing the way they did about Meredith. I mean, they just said the worst things about him you ever heard. I hadn't heard like it was like that. I was shocked.
For our listeners, you're talking about James Meredith, who was the first African-American to integrate Ole Miss, right?
Ole Miss, yeah. I talked to him about 2 months ago. He's still at it.
Yeah? Good.
Yeah, he's a maverick. I mean, even in the Civil Rights Movement, he was always a maverick, but a beautiful guy, and he had his thing. I remember one night he said, I want to go bowling. I said, well, there's no bowling alleys around here. And he said, well, we'll go to Jackson. I said, oh, wait a minute. I don't think we better go to Jackson. He said, well, yeah, let's go to Jackson, go bowling. I said, no. I said, well, what about Memphis? Memphis, we were in Oxford, Mississippi, at the University of Mississippi. So we finally got him up there bowling, but boy, I had to take the National Guard, I had to take the 101st Airborne, which is still on the campus at Ole Miss. We sent 13,000 troops in to protect Meredith finally, if you can believe it. The campus had 4,500 students, and the town had about 5,000. And we couldn't get them out. We couldn't get them to leave. Their theory was it was kind of the Powell doctrine that you got to have overwhelming force. We won't be responsible unless we know we have overwhelming capacity to do it. And, you know, snipers and all this kind of stuff, we just want it. I finally went back in March. I'd been going back and forth. This would be 63. They still said, well, we'll break it down to 2,000. I said, that's ridiculous, 2,000 soldiers. You shouldn't have any soldiers on the campus anyway. Well, this is supposed to be the United States of America. And we finally got the Marshal Service at that time was old guys. They were all political appointees because the Marshal was a political appointee and the whole office was appointed by friends of the senators. So they were good-hearted fellows, but they couldn't walk 100 yards in a minute and a half. But they were providing part of the protection after that, and everything was fine. Meredith graduated.
And went on. I know where he went on. He went on to Columbia Law School because he was a year or so ahead of me, 2 years ahead of me at Columbia.
Yeah.
And then there's a little anecdotal story, which I can't believe is true, but when he was at Columbia at the time, he was in a class that someone told me when I was there. And they said they were looking at a trial that had taken place in the South where an African-American had been convicted of murder but had not gotten a death penalty. He'd gotten life in prison. So the professor was asking the class, how come the guy only got life in prison and didn't get the death penalty? And apparently Meredith raises his hand and he says, well, because he was innocent.
I thought he was going to say because the victim was black.
Right. No, either one.
So take us along now. You're in Mississippi, and then where'd you go next?
Well, I was put in charge of integrating all the schools, desegregating for the first time in the South in 63, which was an incredibly interesting experience in many ways. Yeah. Well, the first one I started on the West, and Baton Rouge was the first one. judge named Gordon West was in charge, he wouldn't meet with me. So I found out he was on the golf links one day, and I went out there, and he said, I'm playing golf, go away.
Really?
Literally, the guy wouldn't meet with the person who was responsible for protecting his order when the kids got into school right. that September. But you'd meet with you'd meet with, of course, the African-American black leadership, and such as it was, they had to keep their heads down. This is 1963. And you'd meet with the sheriff's office, and you'd meet with the local police department, you'd meet with the mayor of the town, you'd meet with the head of the school district, and you'd meet with the principal of the school, try and talk to them about how important it is that everybody be respectful and everybody accept what's right and what the law requires. I went from there to Savannah, Georgia, as I recall. And there are two towns in Georgia, Charleston, South Carolina. Very bitter in Charleston, South Carolina. The school board, though, was just awful, unbelievable. Hmm. These are first graders because, the idea was you start
low, right?
Start and go up. Poor little, beautiful little children, but poor and frightened.
Sure,
families frightened. Then, President Kennedy was killed that fall.
And, this is 1963.
Yeah. I thought I'd never be happy again. And for a long time, I couldn't go over the Memorial Bridge without not shedding a tear, literally, but feeling like it and seeing the eternal flame, as we call it, up there. But now it's, I don't know if it's me or age or time or what it is, but I don't feel it like I did. I guess maybe I've seen so much more suffering and tragedy. I was assigned to protect the marchers on the Selma Montgomery March.
What year was that?
That was in the spring of 65.
So that's under Johnson, obviously.
Yeah. Right. I'd become Deputy Attorney General. Uh-huh. I think President Johnson couldn't decide what to do because Bob Kennedy left the department on, I think it was the 3rd of September of 64. Stayed for nearly a year after the president's murder. I flew up here to New York with him that day. We'd had a ceremony in the courtyard of the Department of Justice. I was still an Assistant Attorney General. And I flew up with him there. Three or four of us came up on the Caroline, landed out Marine Terminal, drove into what was, at the time, a National Guard armory on about 33rd and Park Avenue. And it was really a riot because we were getting out of the car. Bob had dashed ahead. They were, hurry, hurry, they're waiting for you. We get into the armory, and they're taking us upstairs. We can't go on the floor. Have these rings around the armory floor because we were delegates for anything. They take us upstairs. We don't even get to the top of the stairs. And I hear a guy yelling, nominations are now in order for United States Senate. Bang. Do I hear a nomination? And a voice, and we're still coming up the steps. I nominate Robert F. Kennedy.
Well, this was the nominating committee for the Democratic Party?
Convention, Democratic. Yeah. State convention.
Oh, wow. And this was in 65
in September, yeah.
Right.
In September. Then I hear a second, bang. Nominations are now closed. That night, we were over, Bob was laying on his back on the floor when I came in the hotel right across from Madison Square Garden. It's got a new name now. And he said, how'd you like that convention? That's democracy in action, isn't it? So we got to do something to change that. I ran for Senate here in 74.
I remember that race.
Yeah. Went to the convention. It was in Niagara Falls.
This is in 74 when you were nominated.
I was nominated by Frank Serpico. And he was fantastically popular at that time. I remember Samuel was nominated for governor. I walked into the room, this big room where they have a celebration or something, and everybody's crowd around Samuels and Paco, Serpico is with me, and they just all came running towards Serpico. Poor old Samuel was standing over there by himself. I was standing over here by myself. Everybody's around Serpico. This was the height of the movie had just come out, and he was just a big hero and a beautiful, beautiful human being. Herbert X. Blyden from the Attica Prison Rebellion, sure. Second to the nomination.
Herbert, really? Blyden?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Herbert was a beautiful guy from
Trinidad. Ramsey, for people who don't are listening, Ramsey, you were on the first case, right? You represented the first people indicted for murder, right?
Yeah, the only people indicted for.
Who was your client in that first case?
His name was Charles Pernasalis.
Oh, that's right, Pernasalis.
He had been adopted, and he finally found out his real roots. He insisted he was an Indian. Right. His co-defendant,
Dr. Jawea,
was
actually
part Seneca. Yeah, he was a fourth Seneca. Anyway, Herbert X. Blyden seconded the nomination, but it was so sad because people got him left. he made that he had a, you know, he, how you remember, yeah, a beautiful Bob. Guy. I mean, yeah. He looked like a piece of carved mahogany of a god. Had this booming voice, and people just got up and started leaving.
Wow. Oh.
Then I got up and said, I withdraw the nomination, said, I respect all of you, but this isn't a democratic process, and we'll get on by the ballot. We went out and got 150,000 signatures on the ballot and got on and won the Democratic primary.
That's right, you won the Democratic primary.
Got more than half the votes.
But who were you against in the Democratic primary?
Four other people, if I can remember who they were. One, the main guy was, he was the mayor of Syracuse.
Uh-huh. Okay. But who, you lost the election.
Lost the election, yeah.
Who became the senator?
Javits was the senator. And
you were running against Javits, a tough one.
I had more votes on the Democratic line than Javits had on the Republican line, but there were these two independent parties, the liberal and the conservative.
Right. Hmm.
And they wouldn't let, neither one of them would let me into the convention. He got both of them, and they took him over.
They took him over, sure.
We had a $100 limitation, and I went up north, upstate, and said, we've got to abolish handguns, absolutely abolish them. They only kill people and license long guns and ammunition and stop all the killing with guns. Went out to Grumman on Long Island, and said, the war is a terrible thing. You're making a plane that kills people, and you're going to close this plant.
You said that in that election?
We had a good time.
Would have been great if you'd been in the Senate.
Yeah. I had been nominated in 65, in February of 65, to be Deputy Attorney General. Nick Katzenbach, who had been deputy after Byron White went on the court in 62, became attorney general. We had a National Crime Commission, and we were sitting in there. This would have been 66. Nick's presiding, and some guy comes in with a message, and Nick says, excuse me, I've got to leave. You got the commissioners were big shots from all over the country. So he got up and left. I didn't see him again for 2 months. He had been appointed deputy Secretary of State, and that left a vacancy. President Johnson called me that night and said, I want you to know that I can't appoint you Attorney General, and you shouldn't think about it, because it'll just frustrate you. I'm from Texas, you're from Texas, there are too many Texans. He had not worked on my nomination as Assistant Attorney General. He had his candidates. He had four candidates, and he got all of them. John Connally became Secretary of the Navy, and a guy from Oklahoma, Rich Oilman, became Assistant Secretary of State for Policy Planning, which is a job I would love to have had. And a labor guy from San Antonio became Assistant Secretary of Labor. There's one other one. I wasn't among his people he was pushing. I just say that to explain that I took him at his word. So that fall, there was a lot of action, and we had a very thin staff because there had been resignations, vacancy in the Solicitor General's office, the criminal division. There are four divisions that had vacancies, so we were really running to keep up. And Nick was gone. There was no attorney general. I was deputy and acting attorney general. We had a major crime bill, a D.C. crime bill, that brought a lot of heat on President Johnson. He vetoed the D.C. crime bill because it had wiretapping provisions that we opposed. Then I sent over 500 or 600... pardons and commutation applications. They'd been sitting around there for a long time. I read them. I read every one of them. And I said, this guy ought to be pardoned. I don't think I turned any down. But I'm not sure. And I'll be darned if he didn't sign them.
Really?
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
And he thought, this knucklehead, he must know what he's doing. I don't. And he caught uncharted hell, as he'd say for it, because some guy, the plane dealer, came down on him because he pardoned some guy who'd done something that upset the city leadership there and all this kind of stuff. These things have been hanging around for years, and I believe in pardons and commutations anyway. And in the meantime, I was reading about all the people who were going to be attorney general. Clark Clifford's name kept coming up.
Right.
Everybody you could think of who was a prominent lawyer in the country. And my name kept coming up. They didn't know what he told me. And then in February of 65... he called me over one day, which wasn't unusual. I went into the Oval Office, and he said, I'm going to nominate you to be Attorney General. And he punched a button under the desk and said, tell the press to come in. And the press came charging in. I'm in a state of shock.
How old were you then? You were very young.
There was a guy back in the 1800s who was 32.
Yeah, people didn't live that long. That was probably old age then.
And actually, Bob Kennedy was younger. He was 2 years older than me, but he was Attorney General for... Uh-huh. Almost 40.
So how old were you then, Andrew?
I was about 37.
Yeah. I remember the day. I was at Columbia Law School when it happened.
Uh-huh.
And I remember reading the articles. The issue was your father was still on the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
And your father, I don't know if it was a condition of your getting the job that he resigned or something, but your father resigned as a result of your being Attorney General, right?
Yeah, when I got out of the press conference, I brought the Department of Justice out against the death penalty, upset the president, upset Nick, but I was Deputy Attorney General. I had responsibility for the program. I'd opposed all wiretapping. I'd been testifying on those issues. So there was a real question as to what was going to happen when my name went up. When I got out of the press conference, I went to the phone and called the court, tell Dad. Well, he knew about it.
Right.
In fact, his secretary said, before you talk to him, your father has announced his retirement.
Wow.
At the end of the term.
Oh, my gosh.
Wow. Yeah.
That's a big deal in your
career. So I never had, we never had a chance to even talk about it.
Wow. Amazing thing by your dad, right?
Now there's a lot of speculation about it, none of which I've seen I believe to be true. One of the main theory is now that President Johnson wanted to put Thurgood Marshall, who was Solicitor General, whom I had been responsible for bringing down to be Solicitor General, and very anxious about it. I thought it was historically important and would favor him for the court under any circumstances. But I don't think that's it. I think he apparently couldn't find the right person he wanted, and he was getting pressured from people. The war was a big distraction, and he thought the easiest thing probably just to appoint me. I don't really know what it was.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
That's lawanddisorder.org.
Listen now to part two of our interview with Ramsey Clark from our series, Lawyers You'll Like.
I want to ask you a couple of things, one about some cases, but first a couple of issues that are contemporary today. And one of them I just got from my office. You know, we represent one of the people, Mohammed El-Khatani, who is one of the people who's been charged under the new commissions for the 9/11 conspiracy. And of course, they're asking for the death penalty. Apart from everything else that's wrong with the business, they're asking for the death penalty. The Bush administration put out a cable to all of its diplomats around the world saying, look, if the death penalty for war crimes, just remember Nuremberg. It was accepted then to give the death penalty for war crimes. We did it then, and this is just like Nuremberg. And so my office says to me, well, how do we answer that? I mean, I know how to answer it, but I'm just interested in your how you would respond to somebody saying that to you about the death penalty.
President Bush has been contemptuous of every principle of justice and law and freedom to such a degree, but in a way this one stings me more than any other, even the war of aggression against Iraq, which is a supreme international crime and has caused immeasurable havoc. Really, in terms of deaths and suffering, more than our major wars, more than our civil war. We lost 600,000 in the civil war, you know. We were 50% bigger than Iraq.
You know, it's why, Ramsey, I can't ever forgive anyone who voted for this war. We all knew it. Every death I see, I put at the feet of not just the people who voted for it, but the Times and the New Yorker and all, every one of those. Anyway, it's just...
Announcing the death penalty, on top of having held these people criminally all this time, is so contemptuous of life, truth, justice, and humanity that it's hard to even try to reason about it. To compare it to Nuremberg is absurd. We knew who Hermann Göring was, you know. We knew who the generals there were. We even knew who the industrialists there, one that they had in the main trial. There wasn't any question about it, and we didn't hold them for years and years in total isolation. So here are these guys. We just picked them up someplace, and they say things. We hear things. We cause them to say things. So contemptuous of the rule of law and of life itself, and it's so highly political. Between now and the election, it's going to be playing frequently, and so it escalates. Not the disaster that Bush has made for the country economically and for the world militarily and politically, but we're thinking about we're going to kill these people who caused what some are calling the greatest assault on the United States in history, forgetting about Pearl Harbor and a few others, you know. It has to be resisted at every level, and I have such great respect for the Center for Constitutional Rights and you for what you're doing there. I think it's the trials should not be permitted to go forward under any circumstances. They're totally corrupted.
I couldn't agree more. It's completely corrupted.
Totally corrupted and contaminated. It's just sick to try to think you can do justice or find truth in those trials or what it would mean if you did. Nobody could ever believe it.
Yeah, it's barbaric to me. It really is. I had your reaction also when I first saw it. I just said, this is barbaric.
Yeah, it's worse than barbaric. It's cunning and barbaric. I mean, the barbarians, they just kill you, you know.
Yeah.
Here you tinker with these people, you keep them in isolation, then you build nice little places for them to see how nice it is now after you've wiped them out. If any of them can really hold together after what they've been through, it's a testament to the strength of humanity and human nature. But it's just an atrocious and deliberate presentation of a symbol of utter contempt for principle and law and truth and justice. It's heartbreaking. Yeah. And then you kill them, and what have you got? Yeah. Hatred.
Ramsey, how do we get from where we are to where all of us want to be? What do you tell people in terms of the long view of history and trying to get this country back on path that it set out on a couple hundred years ago?
Well, we have a real challenge. I put it in the challenge into two parts. One is the degree to which materialism has overtaken all of our values, the lust for wealth, for things. I mean, I love my granddaughters more than anything, but their highest pleasure in life, and they're all teenagers, is shopping. What do you want to do? Shopping. You got everything you could possibly want. What do you want? Shopping? You're going to waste your time walking around some dumb mall, you know, buying stuff. And these are kids that have seen the poverty of Tanzania and the poverty of Thailand and little kids with nothing, you know, in orphanages, and worked with them in Peru, all three of them. But we just lust for things, and we revere wealth. If we can't break out of that, we're hopeless. I mean, among other things, the earth's going to look like a Swiss cheese because we're just eating holes, and it's been a century now since Mark Twain said that to America, progress is the proliferation of unnecessary necessities. You just, everything becomes necessary, and you got to have it, and you got to have it. And the other thing is our reverence for violence. We glorify violence all the time. Our militarism is staggering. It's beyond anything that ever infected a society. We spend more on the military than the rest of the world combined. Bush has increased the budget 30%. I've been saying for years we need to reduce it 90%. We'll be safer,
right,
if we have any sense.
The military budget.
But he's increased it 30%, and we're now spending more, adjusted for inflation and all these other things that make it possible to kind of compare different epochs, more than at any time since World War II. That means we're spending more on the military now than we were at the height of the Vietnam War. The Vietnam War, we were still in the Cold War. The Vietnam War, we had more than 500,000. We had five times the number of troops in Vietnam that we have in Iraq. We had more than twice as many troops in Korea, more than twice as many troops in Japan, more than twice as many troops in Germany during the period of the Vietnam War than we have in those countries now. We're developing new generations of nuclear weapons and threatening other countries. We're violating the nuclear non-proliferation treaty every day when we ought to be insisting on it and reducing our own arms as our requirement under the treaty in return for other countries not developing nuclear weapons. And look how we glorify the military and militarism and violence. And yet our privileged young people, they don't go into it. As recently as my generation, which doesn't seem recent to you, but it seems recent to me, you wanted to go. World War One, you almost felt you had to go. I know that because I knew my father and I knew his colleagues. And boy, if you didn't go to the war, there's something wrong with you. And particularly if you were more privileged. In World War II, it seemed like, well, you got to go along with it. It's a big draft anyway, and it's hard to get out. You weren't terribly anxious. And then by Vietnam, you do whatever you could to get out. And the ruling class now are the people who escaped serving in the war. And we're using more and more contractors who are straight out of Rambo. I mean, these guys love violence. That's what attracts them. And they get paid very, very well. You watch them in Iraq, and they're a class of their own. They're not like the soldiers. But even among the soldiers, we're bringing in and giving promising citizenship and other rewards to people that are non-citizens. We've probably got 20,000 Latin Americans who don't have citizenship that are in or have been in Iraq, getting killed and fighting our war. But we've got to reverse that, and we've got to face it. And we've got to face the necessity of the government following the law. This is kind of a new thing to me, but Bush is determined to eliminate respect for the basic principles of individual freedom in our Constitution and in our tradition, and thereby to concentrate absolute power in the executive. And we've got to come back to insist upon those principles and to insist upon accountability in the government. That's why I've thought that impeachment is the moral measure of the society today. If we can't see the crime that he's committed, I've been working on Pakistan quite a bit lately. This is an amazing story about Benazir Bhutto. She had finished her studies at Harvard, and she'd gone to Oxford. She's 21 years old, and she joined the Oxford Debate Society and the Oxford Union first year. Her first assignment, she was going to get her first chance to name the debate that she wanted to be in, titled roughly, Resolved That Richard M. Nixon Should Be Impeached for High Crimes and Misdemeanors.
That's great.
But for what high crimes and misdemeanors? Watergate? It's in there, but not really. For the crimes in Vietnam, for the secret bombing of Cambodia. Right. I mean, at 21, she knew what the real problem was, you know. That U.S. militarism was defying the law and secretly doing things that were killing lots of people and alienating people and irreconcilably dividing people. But the Congress is absolutely paralyzed, afraid of it, think it's un-American, and therefore the pomp and circumstance goes on for a criminal in the White House and the vice president, a lot of cabinet members and others.
Have you been surprised at the recent developments in terms of this country torturing individuals?
Well, you know, I've always been an idealist, and that makes you kind of naive. I never dreamed it. I knew from the Marine Corps that war brings out the worst in you. You can get pretty mean. But the idea that we would publicly espouse torture, I did some work on the Philippines just yesterday. They call it the water treatment.
Right. Water cure, the water treatment.
The pictures from there, they got this guy and they hold him down. They're just pouring water down. They didn't have all these fancy waterboard stuff that they have now. They're just pouring water down his throat, you know. But I couldn't believe that either the executive would sponsor it, approve it, or that lawyers in the Department of Justice and elsewhere would approve it. An attorney general would endorse it and write the memorandums for it, and that a successor would decide finally that, you need a little waterboarding once in a while. It's a powerful symbol of the deterioration in constitutionality and law and respect for human dignity.
When I think about it, it is the espousing of it. At least when we were caught before, we denied it or we didn't try and say make it legal. But the fact that we actually espouse it, and I sometimes think, you all remember the figure Candide, right? He would keep getting, slaughtered in the world and always come back. The world could be a better, world's a great place or whatever the line was. And when you say you're an idealist and naive, I sometimes think that And I said, well, I'm a little bit like Candide. You keep getting hit over the head, but you keep popping back up, Ramsey, and thinking you're going to make it better. But anyway, it's the best of all possible worlds. That was the line out of Candide, right?
Yeah. Voltaire was a wise man. But he said some things that are very painful. He said, history is fiction agreed upon.
Yeah, right. Which it's a great line.
I can't take that. That means there's no real truth that you can cling to. There's nothing that's solid like this table that you can be sure of. Yeah. And, it's a fiction that is agreed to. I mean, as you look at it, he's not far from wrong, but we can't accept it.
Mr. Clark, you're a role model for many, many lawyers, especially progressive lawyers. Who have been some of your role models?
Well, I named two earlier that Justice Douglas was a free spirit, extremely inquiring, open mind, and my wife and I loved him very much. He was a great man. Robert Hutchins was an aristocrat, a beautiful intellect, and a dreamer. One of the sad things I regret, we had a program where he and I were debating the Constitution, and he wanted a new Constitution. I said, no, we were both saying exactly what we think, which is what we always did. I mean, he always had a Constitution for the world, you know, and he was always doing that sort of thing. And pretty good ones, as a matter of fact. He thought we needed a new constitution. And I was getting all the applause because, you know, I was on the popular side of it. And at the end he said, well, Ramsey, as long as Chief Justice Earl Warren is on the court, I'll go along with you. But you can't expect that forever. And it was a wisdom that I didn't have.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. I've had lots of other role models.
What would you tell young people who are considering going to law school and making law a career, and they ask you, like they ask us, well, do you think I should do that? What do you tell them?
You know, I went to law school, and there was one quarter where I didn't attend a single class. I didn't enjoy law school, and I was getting a master's degree on the side at the same time. Chicago was a wide-open place. You could take as many courses as you wanted to. You could monitor as many courses as you wanted to. So I was taking a full load in law and a full load in history. Some of the courses were important to me, some of the professors. Ed Levy was brilliant. He became dean of the law school, provost of the university, and president of the university, and years later, attorney general of the United States. In fact, I had urged his appointment as Supreme Court justice much earlier when I was deputy attorney general. He was not a role model exactly, because we were almost, you know, he was 20 years older than me, or 30 maybe, but the university was a temple to him, and when the students were rioting and carrying on, they occupied the offices and they were revealing confidential papers to people and embarrassing everybody. He asked me to come out there and talk to the students, so I stayed with them a night or two. But he couldn't stand it. It was just like they were defiling the temple. But he loved the law. I wrote something the other day that someone had asked me who I thought the greatest attorney generals were, and I said I thought the most learned in the law and the most reverent of the law was, to my knowledge, within my experience, was Ed Levy. But I think the main thing I'd tell him was the main thing I thought when I went in, which is quite a different time, and that is you've got to steel your mind and your intellect to retain your independent judgment and values. If you go in and become an instrumentality of what is overwhelmingly in our society, I'd call it commercial law, economic law, you become a part of the problem. I can remember when the first law firm in Dallas had 20 lawyers, big celebration, Thompson Knight was the name of it. They were in the same building. We had four lawyers. 20 lawyers, I thought, what's happening to the profession, you know? How can you really be an independently minded person doing what you think is right and taking cases you think are right and have 20 lawyers there? It's impossible. Now that firm has merged with others, and they got over 1,000 and around the world. We have so much work to do on world law. It's so feeble, international law, international public law. We have to build constantly on that. I remember Earl Warren, I introduced him to dinner. He spoke at his retirement in 1969. We were sitting together. He looked at me, and he said, Ramsey, said, you're out of a job now, and you don't have much to do. He said, work for an international criminal court.
Who said this to you?
Earl Warren.
Oh, Earl Warren. Yeah. Oh, he said that then in 69?
Yeah, 1969. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I worked on it. I was teaching at the time. I had just an evening seminar, one course at Howard, and did it for 4 or 5 years, and came up here at Brooklyn University and did Brooklyn Law School. Had one student that went to Oxford and spent 2 years there just working on the history and elements that go into creating an international criminal court. Of course, we've created something that Bush so badly battered, Bush and others, the United States, right. battered it into something that's not workable and is highly politicized. But I think there's a great challenge in the law. I mean, just look at what Bush has done. If we can't turn that around, then we'll live in a world of raw power without even holding up the appearance of principle or legality. Legality is almost getting to be a dirty word, but principles remains a respected word, and the law is involved in principles. And the law that we work with is involved in important principles, important to humanity. So you're going to have to swim against the stream, and you're going to have to fight to maintain your own perspective and judgment and values. But if you can do that, I would urge maybe getting a master's degree in history or political science or moral poverty and economics, things like that. So you know, have a better grasp of who you are and what you want to do. But if we all walk away from it, then we surrender any hope for law in the future. And that means much hope for individual rights and for human dignity for the poor and all. My whole course was called Law for an Instrument of Social, as an Instrument of Social Change. And law can be profound in its effect and impact on social change. It has to be. How are we going to come to grips with what capitalism is doing and what the population that's starving and the continuing concentration of wealth in fewer people comparatively and greater poverty among more people all over the world, in the United States and the poor countries? We're faced with a disaster. In the meantime, because it's mindless, we're destroying the sources of life on the planet, you know? So law is a big part of the picture in the future, and it's losing right now. And your professors, with rare exception, won't appreciate your interest in the law. Don't let them get you down.
Mr. Clark, it has been a true honor to have you with us on Law and Disorder. Thank you so much.
Well, the honor is mine. You have a great trio here, and I'm honored to be with you. Hope
Thank
to see you again.
We go now to hear the second of three parts from the event, An Innocent Man in Guantanamo, 5 Years of My Life. This is the title of the memoirs recently released by Murat Kurnaz, who was detained at Guantanamo for 5 years. Kurnaz is a Turkish citizen and legal resident of Germany, who traveled to Pakistan to learn more about his Muslim faith, and was later arrested at a checkpoint, handed to the United States, and eventually taken to Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Here on Law and Disorder, we've emphasized how many of the prisoners got to Guantanamo. They were rounded up by bounty hunters and sold to the United States. In the days during and following the invasion of Afghanistan, the U.S. military blanketed parts of Afghanistan and Pakistan with flyers, encouraging people to turn in suspects, in return for large sums of money. Quote, "Get wealth and power beyond your dreams," read one flyer. "You can receive millions of dollars helping the anti-Taliban forces catch Al-Qaeda and Taliban murderers." The event, presented by Friends of the Library, brought together a panel of lawyers from the U.S. and Germany who fought for Murat's release, and a Guantanamo chaplain who was accused of espionage and subsequently imprisoned. The panel was moderated by our own Michael Ratner. Let's have a listen.
Life at Guantanamo. Outdoors in the cages. In the cage, there were two plastic buckets. One contained water that stank, the other seemed to be the toilet. I didn't need a measuring tape to figure out that the cage was 6 feet by 7. It was around 6 feet high. Guards came with something to eat on paper plates. As the guards approached my cage, all I saw on the plate were 3 spoonfuls of rice, a slice of dry bread, and a plastic spoon. I ate the rice. The sky grew dark. From loudspeakers that must have been hanging somewhere, there came some static and then a call to prayer. The time for evening prayers was a while ago, I thought. But then suddenly the voice was drowned out by loud music. It was the American National Anthem. The rules were constantly changing, and you'd get punished for breaking them. The first night, I learned that I was only allowed to cover my legs and nothing else with the blanket, and that I wasn't allowed to sleep on my side, only on my back. In the days that followed, I learned that I wasn't allowed to get up and walk around my cage. During the day, we had to remain seated, and at night, we had to lie down. If you lay down during the day, you were punished. We weren't allowed to touch the fence or even lean our backs up against it. We weren't allowed to talk. We were not to speak or to look at the guards. We weren't allowed to draw in the sand or whistle. Every time I unknowingly broke a rule, or, because they just invented a new one, did something I shouldn't have, the IRF team would come and beat me. IRF stood for Immediate Reaction Force, and consisted of 5 to 8 soldiers with plastic shields, breastplates, hard plastic knee, elbow, and shoulder protectors, helmets with plastic visors, gloves with hard plastic knuckles, heavy boots, and billy clubs. They came with pepper spray and a kind of pressurized aerosol gun. They sprayed the entire cage and waited until the prisoner was completely unable to resist. Then they stormed in. Abdul. There was a new prisoner in Charlie 1, which had previously been unoccupied. He was young, around my age, maybe 19 or 20. He lay on the ground making soft sounds. He didn't have any legs. His wounds were still fresh. The stumps of his legs were full of pus. The bandages wrapped around them had turned red and yellow. Everything was bloody and moist. I watched as he tried to get up. He crawled over to the bucket in his cage and tried to sit on it. He had to go to the toilet. He tried to raise himself up with his hands on the chain-link fence, but he didn't make it. A guard came and hit his hands with his billy club. The young man fell to the ground.
We have about 10 or 15 minutes before we can go to some questions, and I just want to get a I have a lot of questions here. I have a couple for Bahar right now. One is, of course, you heard Philippe talk about 3 or 4 people being tortured at Guantanamo. And then I also would like you to give us some information about who has been at Guantanamo and what the statistics show, what the government's own witnesses show.
Sure. I'll start with the second one first. So a colleague of mine at Seton Hall Law School did, along with a number of students, a fairly exhaustive study of the government's own public allegations against all the detainees. So he looked at the government's reasons for detaining 535 detainees. And he did this on the backdrop of administration claims about Guantanamo that, for example, they're all captured on the battlefield, that they're the worst of the worst, hardened, vicious, the best trained killers in the world. These are the people who flew planes into the World Trade Center. And what he discovered was, of course, far from those exaggerated claims, which, of course, could only last as long as Guantanamo was as secret as the administration was able to keep it. And he discovered some interesting things. Only 6% of the detainees who wound up in Guantanamo were actually captured by United States forces on the battlefield. The balance, save for 2 or 3%, he can't account for, were turned over by Pakistani forces or the Northern Alliance. And of all the detainees there, only 8%, according to the government's own allegations, were alleged to be al-Qaeda fighters.
One thing I should say on that is the leaflets that were dropped over Afghanistan and Pakistan basically said to people, you can be rich, you will never have to work the rest of your life.
That's right.
If you turn over a Taliban or al-Qaeda fighter.
That's right. And Donald Rumsfeld said, and they're in Arabic and Pashto, Donald Rumsfeld boasted, we'll drop these over Afghanistan. They'll fall over Afghanistan like snowflakes in Chicago in December. And there are endless stories of people just being rounded up by in this very tribal society, political enemies or people just wishing to get rich. And there were numerous raids in Pakistan of mosques by corrupt police officials who held people at ransom, give us some money or go to the Americans. And even the majority were not even have ever alleged to have engaged in a hostile act. 55%. Have not even alleged to have engaged in a hostile act. They're there merely because of some association with groups hostile to the United States. And that is one of the allegations, of course, against Murat Kurnaz, that he associated with someone who's a suicide bomber who actually isn't, but that also this group that he traveled with, Jamiat al-Tabliki, which has something around 40 million members and is avowedly a peaceful missionary group, that this group has at some time had members who have done things hostile to the United States without any allegation that Murat himself was aware of those or participated in them. And, of course, that theory would justify the detention of the 40-plus million members of Jamiat al-Tabliq in Pakistan, Bangladesh, and India.
That was an excerpt from the event titled An Innocent Man in Guantanamo, 5 Years of My Life. We'll hear the third part of this three-part series in the weeks to come.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org. Thank you.